This is Audible.
Simon & Schuster Audio presents Lord of Shadows, The Dark Artifices, Book 2, by Cassandra Clare. Read by James Marsters.
For Jim Hill. I said, pain and sorrow. He said, stay with it. The wound is the place where the light enters you. Rumi. Part 1. Dreamland. Dreamland by Edgar Allan Poe. By a route obscure and lonely, haunted by ill angels only, where an Aedalon named Night on a black throne reigns upright. I have reached these lands, but newly, from an ultimate dim Thule, from a wild weird clime that lieth sublime, out of space, out of time. Bottomless vales and boundless floods, and chasms and caves and titan woods, with forms that no man can discover, for the dews that drip all over, mountains toppling evermore into seas without a shore, seas that restlessly aspire, surging under skies of fire, lakes that endlessly outspread their lone waters, lone and dead, their still waters, still and chilly, with the snows of the lolling lily. But the lakes that thus outspread their lone waters, lone and dead, their sad waters, sad and chilly, with the snows of the lolling lily. By the mountains near the river, murmuring lowly, murmuring ever. By the gray woods, by the swamp, where the toad and the newt encamp. By the dismal tarns and pools, where dwell the ghouls, by each spot the most unholy, in each nook most melancholy. There the traveler meets aghast sheeted memories of the past, shrouded forms that start and sigh as they pass the wanderer by, white-robed forms of friends long given in agony to the earth and heaven. For the heart, whose woes are legion, 'tis a peaceful, soothing region. For the spirit that walks in shadow, 'tis an Eldorado. But the traveler traveling through it may not, dare not, openly view it. Never its mysteries are exposed to the weak human eye unclosed. So wills its king, who hath forbid the uplifting of the fringed lid, and thus the sad soul that here passes beholds it but through darkened glasses. By a route obscure and lonely, haunted by ill angels only, where an Aedalon named Night on a black throne reigns upright. I have wandered home but newly from this ultimate dim Thule. Chapter 1. Still Waters. Kit had only recently found out what a flail was, and now there was a rack of them hanging over his head, shiny and sharp and deadly. He had never seen anything like the weapons room at the Los Angeles Institute before. The walls and floors were white silver granite, and granite islands rose at intervals throughout the room, making the whole place look like the arms and armor exhibit at a museum. There were staves and maces, cleverly designed walking sticks, necklaces, boots, and padded jackets that concealed slim, flat blades for stabbing and throwing. Morning stars covered in terrible spikes and crossbows of all sizes and types. The granite islands themselves were covered with stacks of gleaming instruments carved out of adamas, the quartz-like substance that shadow hunters mined from the earth, and that they alone knew how to turn into swords and blades and steelies. Of more interest to Kit was the shelf that held daggers. It wasn't that he had any particular desire to learn how to use a dagger, nothing beyond the general interest he figured most teenagers had in deadly weapons. But even then, he'd rather be issued a machine gun or a flamethrower. But the daggers were works of art. Their hilts inlaid with gold and silver and precious gems, blue sapphires, cabochon rubies, glimmering patterns of thorns etched in platinum and black diamonds. He could think of at least three people at the shadow market who'd buy them off him for good money, no questions asked. Maybe four. Kit stripped off the denim jacket he was wearing. He didn't know which of the Blackthorns it had belonged to originally. He'd woken up the morning after he'd come to the Institute to find a freshly laundered pile of clothes at the foot of his bed and shrugged on a padded jacket. He caught a glimpse of himself in the mirror at the far end of the room. Ragged blonde hair, the last of fading bruises on his pale skin. He unzipped the inside pocket of the jacket and began to stuff it with sheathed daggers, picking the ones with the fanciest hilts. The door to the weapons room swung open. Kit dropped the dagger he was holding back onto the shelf and turned around hastily. He thought he slipped out of his bedroom without being noticed, but if there was one thing he'd come to realize during his short time at the Institute, it was that Julian Blackthorne noticed everything, and his siblings weren't far behind. But it wasn't Julian. It was a young man Kit had never seen before, though something about him was familiar. He was tall, with tousled blonde hair and a shadow hunter's build. Broad shoulders, muscular arms, the black lines of the runic marks they protected themselves with, peeking out from the collar and cuffs of his shirt. His eyes were an unusual dark gold color. He wore a heavy silver ring on one finger, as many of the shadow hunters did. He raised an eyebrow at Kit. "Like weapons, do you?" he said. "They're all right." Kit backed up a little toward one of the tables, hoping the daggers in his inside pocket didn't rattle. The man went over to the shelf Kit had been rifling through and picked up the dagger he'd dropped. "You picked a good one here," he said. "See the inscription on the handle?" Kit didn't. "It was made by one of the descendants of Wayland the Smith, who made Durandal and Cortana." The man spun the dagger between his fingers before setting it back on its shelf. "Nothing as extraordinary as Cortana, but daggers like that will always return to your hand after you throw them. Convenient." Kit cleared his throat. "It must be worth a lot," he said. "I doubt the Blackthorns are looking to sell," said the man dryly. "I'm Jace, by the way. Jace Herondale." He paused. He seemed to be waiting for a reaction, which Kit was determined not to give him. He knew the name Herondale, all right. It felt like it was the only word anyone had said to him in the past 2 weeks. But that didn't mean he was going to give the man, Jace, the satisfaction he was clearly looking for. Jace looked unmoved by Kit's silence. "And you're Christopher Herondale." "How do you know that?" Kit said, keeping his voice flat and unenthusiastic. He hated the name Herondale. He hated the word. "Family resemblance," said Jace. "We look alike. In fact, you look like drawings of a lot of Herondales I've seen." He paused. "Also, Emma sent me a cell phone picture of you." Emma. Emma Carstairs had saved Kit's life. They hadn't spoken much since, though. In the wake of the death of Malcolm Fade, the High Warlock of Los Angeles, everything had been in chaos. He hadn't been anyone's first priority, and besides, he had a feeling she thought of him as a little kid. "Fine, I'm Kit Herondale. People keep telling me that, but it doesn't mean anything to me," Kit set his jaw. I'm a rook. Kit Rook. I know what your father told you, but you're a Herondale, and that does mean something.
What?
What does it mean? Kit demanded. Chase leaned back against the wall of the weapons room, just under a display of heavy claymores. Kit hoped one would fall on his head.
I know you're aware of shadow hunters, he said. A lot of people are, especially downworlders and mundanes with the sight.
Which is what you thought you were, correct?
I never thought I was a mundane, said Kit. Didn't shadow hunters understand how it sounded when they used that word?
Chase ignored him, though. Shadow hunter society and history, those aren't things most people who aren't Nephilim know about. The shadow hunter world is made up of families, each of which has a name they cherish. Each family has a history we pass on to each successive generation. We bear the glories and the burdens of our names, the good and the bad our ancestors have done through all our lives. We try to live up to our names so that those who come after us will bear lighter burdens. He crossed his arms over his chest. His wrists were covered in marks. There was one that looked like an open eye on the back of his left hand. Kit had noticed all shadow hunters seemed to have that one. Among shadow hunters, your last name is deeply meaningful. The Herondales have been a family who have shaped the destinies of shadow hunters for generations. There aren't many of us left. In fact, everyone thought I was the last. Only Jim and Tessa had faith you existed. They looked for you for a long time. Jim and Tessa. Along with Emma, they had helped Kit escape the demons who had murdered his father. And they had told him a story. The story of a Herondale who had betrayed his friends and fled, starting a new life away from other Nephilim. A new life and a new family line. I heard about Tobias Herondale, he said. So, I'm the descendant of a big coward.
People are flawed, Chase said.
Not every member of your family is going to be awesome. But when you see Tessa again, and you will, she can tell you about Will Herondale, and James Herondale, and me, of course, he added modestly. As far as shadow hunters go, I'm a pretty big deal. Not to intimidate you.
I don't feel intimidated, said Kit, wondering if this guy was for real.
There was a gleam in Jace's eye as he spoke that indicated that he might not take what he was saying all that seriously, but it was hard to be sure.
I feel like I want to be left alone.
I know it's a lot to digest, Jace said. He reached out to clap Kit on the back. But Clary and I will be here for as long as you need us to...
The clap on the back dislodged one of the daggers in Kit's pocket.
It clattered to the ground between them, winking up from the granite floor like an accusing eye.
Right, Jace said into the ensuing silence. So you're stealing weapons.
Kit, who knew the pointlessness of an obvious denial, said nothing. Okay, look, I know your dad was a crook, but you're a shadow hunter now, and...
Wait.
What else is in that jacket? Jace demanded. He did something complicated with his left boot that kicked the dagger up into the air. He caught it neatly, the rubies in the hilt scattering light.
Take it off.
Silently, Kit shucked off his jacket and threw it down on the table. Jace flipped it over and opened the inside pocket. They both gazed silently at the gleam of blades and precious stones.
So, Jace said, you were planning on running away, I take it.
Why should I stay? Kit exploded. He knew he shouldn't, but he couldn't help it. It was too much. The loss of his father, his hatred of the Institute, the smugness of the Nephilim, their demands that he accept a last name he didn't care about, didn't want to care about. I don't belong here. You can tell me all this stuff about my name, but it doesn't mean anything to me. I'm Johnny Rook's son. I've been training my whole life to be like my dad, not be like you. I don't need you. I don't need any of you. All I need is some startup money so I can set up my own booth at the shadow market.
Jace's gold eyes narrowed, and for the first time, Kit saw under the arrogant, joking facade the gleam of sharp intelligence. And so what? Your dad sold information. It took him years and a lot of bad magic to build up those connections. You want to sell your soul like that so you can scratch out a living on the edges of downworld? And what about what killed your dad? You saw him die, didn't you? Demons, yeah, but somebody sent them. The guardian might be dead, but that doesn't mean no one's looking for you. You're 15 years old. You might think you want to die, but trust me, you don't. Kit swallowed. He tried to picture himself standing behind the counter of a booth at the shadow market, the way he had for the past few days. But the truth was he'd always been safe at the market because of his dad. Because people were afraid of Johnny Rook. What would happen to him there without his dad's protection? "But I'm not a shadow hunter," Kit said. He glanced around the room at the millions of weapons and piles of Adamus, the gear and body armor and weapon belts. It was ridiculous. He wasn't a ninja. "I wouldn't even know how to start to be one." "Give it another week," Chase said. "Another week here at the Institute. Give yourself a chance. Emma told me how you fought off those demons who killed your dad. Only a shadow hunter could have done that." Kit barely remembered battling the demons in his father's house, but he knew he'd done it. His body had taken over, and he'd fought, and he'd even, in a small, strange, hidden way, enjoyed it. "This is what you are," said Jace. "You're a shadow hunter. You're part angel. You have the blood of angels in your veins. You're a Herondale, which, by the way, means that not only are you part of a stunningly good-looking family, but you're also part of a family that owns a lot of valuable property, including a London townhouse and a manor in Idris, which you're probably entitled to part of, you know, if you were interested." Kit looked at the ring on Jace's left hand. It was silver, heavy, and looked old and valuable.
"I'm listening."
"All I'm saying is to give it a week. After all," Chase grinned, "Herondales can't resist a challenge." "A two-theta demon," Julian said into the phone, his eyebrows crinkling. "That's basically a squid, right?" The reply was inaudible. Emma could recognize Ty's voice, but not the words. "Yeah, we're at the pier," Julian went on. "We haven't seen anything yet, but we've just arrived. Too bad they don't have designated parking spots for shadow hunters here." Her mind only half on Julian's voice, Emma glanced around. The sun had just gone down. She always loved the Santa Monica Pier, since she was a little girl and her parents had taken her there to play air hockey and ride the old-fashioned merry-go-round. She loved the junk food, burgers and milkshakes, fried clams and giant swirled lollipops, and Pacific Park, the rundown amusement park at the very end of the pier, overlooking the Pacific Ocean. The mundanes had poured millions of dollars into revamping the pier into a tourist attraction over the years. Pacific Park was full of new, shiny rides. The old churro carts were gone, replaced by artisanal ice cream and lobster platters. But the boards under Emma's feet were still warped and weathered by years of sun and salt. The air still smelled like sugar and seaweed. The merry-go-round still spilled its mechanical music into the air. There were still coin-toss games where you could win a giant stuffed panda. And there were still dark spaces under the pier where aimless mundanes gathered and sometimes more sinister things. That was the thing about being a shadow hunter, Emma thought, glancing toward the massive Ferris wheel decorated with gleaming LED lights. A line of mundanes, eager to get on, stretched down the pier past the railings. She could glimpse the black-blue sea, tipped with white where the waves broke. Shadow hunters saw the beauty in the things mundanes created.
the lights of the Ferris wheel reflecting off the ocean so brightly that it looked as if someone were setting off fireworks underwater. Red, blue, green, purple, and gold. But they saw the darkness, too. The danger. And the rot.
"What's wrong?" Julian asked. He'd slid his phone into the pocket of his gear jacket. The wind, there was always wind on the pier, the wind that blew ceaselessly off the ocean, smelling of salt in faraway places, lifted the soft waves of his brown hair, made them kiss his cheeks and temples. "Dark thoughts," Emma wanted to say. She couldn't, though. Once, Julian had been the person she could tell everything. Now, he was the one person she couldn't tell anything. Instead, she avoided his gaze.
"Where are Mark and Christina?"
"Over there," he pointed, "by the ring toss." Emma followed his gaze to the brightly painted stand where people competed to see who could toss a plastic ring and land it around the neck of one of a dozen lined-up bottles. She tried not to feel superior that this was apparently something mundanes found difficult. Julian's half-brother, Mark, held three plastic rings in his hand. Christina, her dark hair caught up in a neat bun, stood beside him, eating caramel corn and laughing. Mark threw the rings, all three at once. Each spiraled out in a different direction and landed around the neck of a bottle. Julian sighed.
"So much for being inconspicuous."
A mixture of cheers and noises of disbelief went up from the mundanes at the ring toss. Fortunately, there weren't many of them, and Mark was able to collect his prize, something in a plastic bag, and escape with a minimum of fuss. He headed back toward them with Christina at his side. The tips of his pointed ears peeked through the loops of his light hair, but he was glamored so that mundanes wouldn't see them. Mark was half fairy, and his downworlder blood showed itself in the delicacy of his features, the tips of his ears, and the angularity of his eyes and cheekbones.
"So it's a squid demon," Emma said, mostly just to have something to say to fill the silence between her and Julian.
There were a lot of silences between her and Julian these days. It had only been 2 weeks since everything had changed, but she felt the difference profoundly in her bones. She felt this distance, though he had never been anything but scrupulously polite and kind ever since she had told him about her and Mark.
"Apparently," Julian said.
Mark and Christina had come into earshot. Christina was finishing her caramel corn and looking sadly into the bag, as if hoping more would appear. Emma could relate. Mark, meanwhile, was gazing down at his prize.
"It climbs up the side of the pier and snatches people, mostly kids, anyone leaning over the side taking a picture at night. It's been getting braver, though. Apparently someone spotted it inside the game area near the table hockey. Is that a goldfish?"
Mark held up his plastic bag. Inside it, a small orange fish swam around in a circle.
"This is the best patrol we've ever done," he said. "I've never been awarded a fish before."
Emma sighed inwardly. Mark had spent the past few years of his life with the Wild Hunt, the most anarchic and feral of all fairies. They rode across the sky on all manner of enchanted beings, motorcycles, horses, deer, massive, snarling dogs, and scavenged battlefields, taking valuables from the bodies of the dead and giving them in tribute to the fairy courts. He was adjusting well to being back among his Shadow Hunter family, but there were still times when ordinary life seemed to take him by surprise. He noticed now that everyone was looking at him with raised eyebrows. He looked alarmed and placed a tentative arm around Emma's shoulders, holding out the bag in the other hand.
"I have won for you a fish, my fair one," he said, and kissed her on the cheek.
It was a sweet kiss, gentle and soft, and Mark smelled like he always did, like cold outside air and green-growing things. And it made absolute sense, Emma thought, for Mark to assume that everyone was startled because they were waiting for him to give her his prize. She was, after all, his girlfriend. She exchanged a worried glance with Christina, whose dark eyes had gotten very large. Julian looked as if he were about to throw up blood. It was only a brief look before he schooled his features back into indifference, but Emma drew back from Mark, smiling at him apologetically.
"I couldn't keep a fish alive," she said. "I kill plants just by looking at them."
"I suspect I would have the same problem," Mark said, eyeing the fish. "It is too bad. I was going to name it Magnus, because it has sparkly scales." At that, Christina giggled. Magnus Bane was the high warlock of Brooklyn, and he had a penchant for glitter. "I suppose I had better let him go free," Mark said. Before anyone could say anything, he made his way to the railing of the pier and emptied the bag, fish and all, into the sea.
"Does anyone want to tell him that goldfish are freshwater fish and can't survive in the ocean?" said Julian quietly.
"Not really," said Christina.
"Did he just kill Magnus?" Emma asked, but before Julian could answer, Mark whirled around. All humor had gone from his expression.
"I just saw something scuttle up one of the pilings below the pier. Something very much not human."
Emma felt a faint shiver pass over her skin. The demons who made the ocean their habitation were rarely seen on land. Sometimes she had nightmares where the ocean turned itself inside out and vomited its contents onto the beach. Spiny, tentacled, slimy, blackened things, half crushed by the weight of the water. Within seconds, each of the shadow hunters had a weapon in hand. Emma was clutching her sword Cortana, a golden blade given to her by her parents. Julian held a seraph blade, and Christina her butterfly knife.
"Which way did it go?" Julian asked.
"Toward the end of the pier," said Mark. He alone had not reached for a weapon, but Emma knew how fast he was. His nickname in the Wild Hunt had been Elf Shot, for he was swift and accurate with a bow and arrow or a thrown blade.
"Toward the amusement park."
"I'll go that way," Emma said. "Try to drive it off the edge of the pier. Mark, Christina, you go down under. Catch it if it tries to crawl back into the water." They barely had time to nod, and Emma was off and running. The wind tugged at her braided hair as she wove through the crowd toward the lighted park at the pier's end. Cortana felt warm and solid in her hand, and her feet flew over the sea-warped wooden slats. She felt free, her worries cast aside, everything in her mind and body focused on the task at hand. She could hear footsteps beside her. She didn't need to look to know it was Jules. His footsteps had been beside her all the years she had been the fighting shadow hunter. His blood had been spilled when hers was. He had saved her life, and she had saved his. He was part of her warrior self. "There," she heard him say, but she'd already seen it. A dark, humped shape clambering up the support structure of the Ferris wheel. The carriages continued to rotate around it, the passengers shrieking in delight, unaware. Emma hit the line for the wheel and started shoving her way through it. She and Julian had put glamoroons on before they'd gotten to the pier, and they were invisible to mundane eyes. That didn't mean they couldn't make their presences felt, though. Mundanes in line swore and yelled as she stomped on feet and elbowed her way to the front. A carriage was just swinging down. A couple, a girl eating purple cotton candy and her black-clad, lanky boyfriend, about to climb in. Glancing up, Emma saw a flicker as the Tuthida demon slithered around the top of the wheel support. Swearing, Emma pushed past the couple, nearly knocking them aside, and leapt into the carriage. It was octagonal, a bench running around the inside with plenty of room to stand. She heard yells of surprise as the carriage rose, lifting her away from the scene of chaos she'd created below. The couple who'd been about to board the wheel yelling at the ticket taker, and the people in line behind them yelling at each other. The carriage rocked under her feet as Julian landed beside her, setting it to swinging. He craned his head up. "Do you see it?" Emma squinted. She had seen the demon, she was sure of that, but it seemed to have vanished. From this angle, the Ferris wheel was a mess of bright lights, spinning spokes and white-painted iron bars. The two carriages below her and Julian were empty of people. The line must still be sorting itself out.
Good, Emma thought. The fewer people who got on the wheel, the better.
Stop. She felt Julian's hand on her arm, turning her around.
Her whole body tensed. "Runes," he said shortly, and she realized he was holding his steely in his free hand. The carriage was still rising. Emma could see the beach below, the dark water spilling up onto the sand, the hills of Palisades Park rising vertically above the highway, crowned with a fringe of trees and greenery. The stars were dim but visible beyond the bright lights of the pier. Julian held her arm, neither roughly nor gently, but with a sort of clinical distance. He turned it over, his steely describing quick motions over her wrist, inking runes of protection there, runes of speed and agility and enhanced hearing. This was the closest Emma had been to Jules in 2 weeks. She felt dizzy from it, a little drunk. His head was bent, his eyes fixed on the task at hand, and she took the opportunity to absorb the sight of him. The lights of the wheel had turned amber and yellow. They powdered his tanned skin with gold. His hair fell in loose, fine waves over his forehead. She knew the way the skin by the corners of his mouth was soft, and the way his shoulders felt under her hands, strong and hard and vibrant. His lashes were long and thick, so dark that they seemed to have been charcoaled. She half expected them to leave a dusting of black powder on the tops of his cheekbones when he blinked. He was beautiful. He had always been beautiful, but she had noticed it too late. And now she stood with her hands at her sides and her body aching because she couldn't touch him. She could never touch him again. He finished what he was doing and spun the steely around so the handle was toward her. She took it without a word as he pulled aside the collar of his shirt under his gear jacket. The skin there was a shade paler than the tan skin on his face and hands, scored over and over with the faint white marks of runes that had been used up and faded away. She had to move a step nearer to mark him. The runes bloomed under the tip of the steely, agility, night vision. Her head reached just to the level of his chin. She was staring directly at his throat and saw him swallow. "Just tell me," he said. "Just tell me that he makes you happy. That mark makes you happy." She jerked her head up. She had finished the runes. He reached to take the steely from her motionless hand. For the first time in what felt like forever, he was looking directly at her. His eyes turned dark blue by the colors of the night sky and the sea, spreading out all around them as they neared the top of the wheel. "I'm happy, Jules," she said. What was one lie among so many others? She had never been someone who lied easily, but she was finding her way. When the safety of people she loved depended on it, she'd found she could lie.
This is smarter, safer for both of us."
The line of his gentle mouth hardened. "That's not—" she gasped. A writhing shape rose up behind them. It was the color of an oil slick, its fringed tentacles clinging to the spoke of the wheel. Its mouth was wide open, a perfect circle ringed with teeth.
"Jules!"
she shouted, and flung herself from the carriage, catching onto one of the thin iron bars that ran between the spokes. Dangling by one hand, she slashed out with Cortana, catching the Tuthita as it reared back. It yowled and ichor sprayed. Emma cried out as it splashed her neck, burning her skin. A knife punched into the demon's round, ribbed body. Pulling herself up onto a spoke, Emma glanced down to see Julian poised on the edge of the carriage, another knife already in hand. He sighted down along his arm, let the second knife fly. It clanged off the bottom of an empty carriage. The Tuthita, incredibly fast, had whipped its way out of sight. Emma could hear it scrabbling downward along the tangle of metal bars that made up the inside of the wheel. Emma sheathed Cortana and began to crawl along the length of her spoke, heading toward the bottom of the wheel. LED lights exploded around her in purple and gold. There was ichor and blood on her hands, making the descent slippery. Incongruously, the view from the wheel was beautiful, the sea and the sand opening in front of her in all directions, as if she were dangling off the edge of the world. She could taste blood in her mouth and salt. Below her, she could see Julian, out of the carriage, clambering along the lower spoke. He glanced up at her and pointed. She followed the line of his hand and saw the Tuthita nearly at the wheel's center. Its tentacles were whipping around its body, slamming at the heart of the wheel. Emma could feel the reverberations through her bones. She craned her neck to see what it was doing and went cold. The center of the ride was a massive bolt, holding the wheel onto its structural supports. The Tuthita was yanking at the bolt, trying to rip it free. If the demon succeeded in disengaging it, the whole structure would pull away from its moorings and roll off the pier like a disconnected bicycle wheel. Emma had no illusions that anyone on the wheel or near it would survive. The wheel would crumple in on itself, crushing anyone underneath. Demons thrived on destruction, on the energy of death. It would feast. The Ferris wheel rocked. The Tuthita had its tentacles fastened firmly to the iron bolt at the wheel's heart and was twisting it. Emma redoubled her crawling speed, but she was too far above the wheel's middle. Julian was closer, but she knew the weapons he was carrying, two knives which he'd already thrown, and seraph blades which weren't long enough for him to reach the demon. He looked up at her as he stretched his body out along the iron bar, wrapping his left arm around it to anchor himself, and held the other arm out, his hand outstretched. She knew, immediately, without having to wonder what he was thinking. She breathed in deep and let go of the spoke. She fell, down toward Julian, stretching out her own hand to reach for his. They caught and clasped, and she heard him gasp as he took her weight. She swung forward and down, her left hand locked around his right, and with her other hand she whipped Cortana from its sheath. The weight of her fall carried her forward, swinging her toward the middle of the wheel. The Tuthita demon raised its head as she sailed toward it, and for the first time she saw its eyes. They were oval, glossed with a protective mirror-like coating. They almost seemed to widen like human eyes as she whipped Cortana forward, driving it down through the top of the demon's head and into its brain. Its tentacles flailed, a last dying spasm as its body pulled free of the blade and skittered, rolling along one of the downward slanted spokes of the wheel. It reached the end and tumbled off. In the distance, Emma thought she heard a splash, but there was no time to wonder. Julian's hand had tightened on hers, and he was pulling her up. She slammed Cortana back into its sheath as he hauled her up, up onto the spoke, where he was lying, so that she collapsed awkwardly, half on top of him. He was still clasping her hand, breathing hard. His eyes met hers, just for a second. Around them, the wheel spun, lowering them back down toward the ground. Emma could see crowds of mundanes on the beach, the shimmer of the water along the shoreline, even a dark head and a light one that could be Mark and Christina. "Good teamwork," Julian said finally. "I know," Emma said, and she did. That was the worst thing, that he was right, that they still worked so perfectly together as Parabatai, as warrior partners, as a matched pair of soldiers who could never, ever be parted. Mark and Christina were waiting for them under the pier. Mark had kicked off his shoes and was partway into the ocean water. Christina was folding away her butterfly knife. At her feet was a patch of slimy, drying sand. "Did you see the squid thingy fall off the Ferris wheel?" Emma asked as she and Julian drew near. Christina nodded. "It fell into the shallows. It wasn't quite dead, so Mark dragged it up onto the beach and we finished it off." She kicked at the sand in front of her. "It was very disgusting, and Mark got slime on him." "I've got ichor on me," Emma said, looking down at her stained gear. "That was one messy demon." "You are still very beautiful," Mark said with a gallant smile. Emma smiled back at him, as much as she could. She was unbelievably grateful to Mark, who was playing his part in all this without a word of complaint, though he must have found it strange. In Christina's opinion, Mark was getting something out of the pretense, but Emma couldn't imagine what. It wasn't as if Mark liked lying. He'd spent so many years among fairies who were incapable of untruths that he found it unnatural. Julian had stepped away from them and was on the phone again, speaking in a low voice. Mark splashed up out of the water and jammed his wet feet into his boots. Neither he nor Christina was fully glamored, and Emma noticed the stares of mundane passers-by as he came toward her, because he was tall and beautiful, and because he had eyes that shone brighter than the lights of the Ferris wheel, and because one of his eyes was blue and the other one was gold,
and because there was something about him, something indefinably strange, a trace of the wildness of fairy that never failed to make Emma think of untrammeled, wide-open spaces, of freedom and lawlessness. "I am a lost boy," his eyes seemed to say. "Find me."
Reaching Emma, he lifted his hand to push back a lock of her hair. A wave of feeling went through her, sadness and exhilaration, a longing for something, though she didn't know what. "That was Diana," Julian said, and even without looking at him, Emma could picture his face as he spoke. Gravity, thoughtfulness, a careful consideration of whatever the situation was. "Jason Clary have arrived with a message from the consul. They're holding a meeting at the Institute, and they want us there now." Chapter 2. Boundless Floods. The four of them went straight through the Institute to the library, without pausing to change their gear. Only when they'd burst into the room and Emma realized she, Mark, Christina, and Julian had all tracked in sticky demon ichor did she pause to wonder if perhaps they should have stopped to shower. The roof of the library had been damaged 2 weeks before and hastily repaired, the stained glass skylight replaced with plain, warded glass, the intricately decorated ceiling now covered over with a layer of rune-carved rowan wood. The wood of rowan trees was protective. It kept out dark magic. It also had an effect on fairies. Emma saw Mark wince and look up sideways as they entered the room. He told her proximity to too much rowan made him feel as if his skin were powdered with tiny sparks of fire. She wondered what effect it would have on a full-blood fairy.
"Glad to see you made it," said Diana.
She was sitting at the head of one of the long library tables, her hair pulled back into a sleek bun. A thick gold chain necklace glittered around her dark skin. Her black and white dress was, as always, pristinely spotless and wrinkle-free. Beside her was Diego Rocio Rosales, notable to the Clave for being a highly trained centaurian, and to the Blackthorns for having the nickname Perfect Diego. He was irritatingly perfect. Ridiculously handsome, a spectacular fighter, smart, and unfailingly polite. He'd also broken Christina's heart before she had left Mexico, which meant that normally Emma would be plotting his death, but she couldn't because he and Christina had gotten back together 2 weeks ago. He cast a smile at Christina now, his even white teeth flashing. His centaurian pin glittered at his shoulder, the words primi ordine, visible against the silver. He wasn't just a centaurian. He was one of the first company, the very best of the graduating class from the Scholomance. Because, of course, he was perfect. Across from Diana and Diego sat two figures who were very familiar to Emma, Jace Herondale and Clary Fairchild, the heads of the New York Institute, though when Emma had met them, they'd been teenagers the age she was now. Jace was all tousled, golden handsomeness, looks he'd grown into gracefully over the years. Clary was red hair, stubborn green eyes, and a deceptively delicate face. She had a will like iron, as Emma had good cause to know. Clary jumped to her feet now, her face lighting up as Jace leaned back in his chair with a smile.
"You're back," she cried, rushing toward Emma.
She wore jeans and a threadbare Made in Brooklyn t-shirt that had probably once belonged to her best friend, Simon. It looked worn and soft, exactly like the sort of shirt Emma had often filched from Julian and refused to give back.
"How'd it go with a squid demon?"
Emma was prevented from answering by Clary's enveloping hug.
"Great," said Mark. "Really great. They're so full of liquid squids."
He actually seemed pleased about it. Clary let Emma go and frowned down at the ichor, seawater, and undefinable slime that had transferred themselves to her shirt.
I see what you mean.
I'm just going to welcome you all from over here, said Jace, waving. There's a disturbing smell of calamari wafting from your general direction. There was a giggle, quickly stifled. Emma glanced up and saw legs dangling between the railings of the upstairs gallery. With amusement, she recognized Ty's long limbs and Livy's patterned stockings. There were nooks up on the gallery level that were perfect for eavesdropping. She couldn't count how many of Andrew Blackthorne's meetings she and Julian had spied on as kids, drinking up the knowledge and sense of importance that being present at a conclave meeting brought. She glanced sideways at Julian, seeing him note Ty and Livy's presence, knowing the moment he decided, as she had, not to say anything about it. His whole thought process was visible to her in the quirk of his smile. Odd how transparent he was to her in his unguarded moments, and how little she could tell what he was thinking when he chose to hide it. Christina went over to Diego, bumping her hand gently against his shoulder. He kissed her wrist. Emma saw Mark glance at them, his expression unreadable. Mark had talked to her about many things in the past 2 weeks, but not Christina. Not ever Christina.
So, how many sea demons does that make it? Asked Diana.
In total. She gestured for everyone to take seats around the table. They sat down, squelching slightly. Emma next to Mark, but across from Julian. He answered Diana as calmly as if he wasn't dripping ichor onto the polished floor.
A few smaller ones this past week, said Julian. But that's normal when it storms. They wash up on the beach. We ran some patrols. The Ashdowns ran some further south. I think we got them all.
This was the first really big one, said Emma.
I mean, I've only seen a few that big before. They don't usually come out of the ocean.
Jace and Clary exchanged a look.
Is there something we should know about? Emma said.
Are you collecting really big sea demons to decorate the Institute or something?
Jace leaned forward, his elbows on the table. He had a calm, cat-like face with unreadable amber eyes. Clary had once said that the first time she'd ever seen him, she thought he looked like a lion. Emma could see it. Lions seemed so calm and almost lazy until they exploded into action.
Maybe we should talk about why we're here, he said.
I thought you were here about Kit, Julian said. What with him being a Herondale and all.
There was a rustle from upstairs and a faint muttering. Ty had been sleeping in front of Kit's door for the past nights, an odd behavior no one remarked on. Emma assumed Ty found Kit unusual and interesting, in the manner that he sometimes found bees and lizards unusual and interesting.
Partly, said Jace. We just returned from a council meeting in Idris. That's why it took us so long to get here, though I wanted to come as fast as possible when I heard about Kit.
He sat back and threw an arm over the back of his chair.
You won't be surprised to know there was a great deal of discussion about the Malcolm situation.
You mean the situation where the High Warlock of Los Angeles turned out to be a spree killer and a necromancer? Julian said. There were layers of implication, clear in his voice. The Clave hadn't suspected Malcolm, had approved of his appointment to the post of High Warlock, had done nothing to stop the murders he committed. It had been the Blackthorns who had done that. There was another giggle from above. Diana coughed to hide a smile.
Sorry, she said to Jason Clary. I think we have mice.
I didn't hear anything, Jace said.
We're just surprised the council meeting ended so quickly, Emma said. We thought we might have to give testimony about Malcolm and everything that happened.
Emma and the Blackthorns had given testimony in front of the council before. Years before, after the Dark War. It wasn't an experience Emma was excited to repeat, but it would have been a chance to tell their side of what had happened. To explain why they had worked in cooperation with the fairies, in direct contradiction of the laws of the Cold Peace. Why they had investigated the High Warlock of Los Angeles, Malcolm Fade, without telling the Clave they were doing it. What they had done when they had found him, guilty of heinous crimes.
why Emma had killed him.
"You already told Robert, the Inquisitor," said Clary. "He believed you. He testified on your behalf."
Julian raised an eyebrow.
Robert Lightwood, the Inquisitor of the Clave, was not a warm and friendly sort of man. They'd told him what had happened because they'd been forced to, but he wasn't the kind of person you could imagine doing you favors.
"Robert's not so bad," Jace said.
"Really?
He's mellowed since he's become a grandfather. And the fact is, the Clave is actually less interested in you than they were in the Black Volume."
"Apparently no one realized it was ever in the library here," said Clary. "The Cornwall Institute is famous for having a considerably large selection of books on dark magic. The original Malleus Maleficarum, the Demonatia. Everyone thought it was there, properly locked up."
"The Blackthorns used to run the Cornwall Institute," said Julian. "Maybe my father brought it with him when he got the appointment to run the Institute here." He looked troubled. "Though I don't know why he would have wanted it."
"Maybe Arthur brought it," suggested Christina. "He's always been fascinated with ancient books."
Emma shook her head.
"Can't have. The book had to have been here when Sebastian attacked the Institute, before Arthur came."
"How much of the fact that they didn't want us there to testify had to do with them discussing whether I ought to be allowed to stay?" said Mark.
"Some," Clary said, meeting his gaze levelly. "But, Mark, we never would have let them make you return to the hunt. Everyone would have risen up."
Diego nodded.
"The Clave has deliberated, and they're fine with Mark remaining here with his family. The original order only forbids shadow hunters from looking for him. But he came to you, so the order hasn't been contravened."
Mark nodded stiffly. He had never seemed like perfect Diego.
"And believe me," Clary added, "they were very happy to use that loophole. I think even the most fairy-hating of them feel for what Mark went through."
"But not for what Helen has gone through," said Julian. "Any word on her return?"
"Nothing," said Jace. "I'm sorry they wouldn't hear of it."
Mark's expression tensed. In that moment, Emma could see the warrior in him. The dark shadow of the battlefields, the wild hunt stalked. The walker among the bodies of the dead.
"We'll keep at them," said Diana. "Having you back is a victory, Mark. We'll press that victory. But right now..."
"What's happening right now?" Mark demanded. "Isn't the crisis over?"
"We're shadow hunters," Chase said. "You'll find that the crisis is never over."
"Right now," Diana went on, "the council just finished discussing the fact that large sea demons have been spotted all up and down the coast of California in record numbers. There have been more seen in the past week than in the past decade. That Tuthida you fought wasn't an outlier.
We think it's because Malcolm's body and the Black Volume are still out there in the ocean," said Clary. "And we think it may be because of the spells Malcolm cast during his life."
"But a warlock's spells disappear when they die," protested Emma. She thought of Kit. The wards Malcolm had placed around the Rook's house had vanished when he died. Demons had attacked within hours. "We went up to his house after he died to look for evidence of what he was doing. The whole thing had disintegrated into a slag heap."
Jace had disappeared under the table. He appeared a moment later holding Church, the Institute's part-time cat. Church had its paws stuck straight out and a look of satisfaction on his face.
"We thought the same thing," said Jace, settling the cat on his lap. "But apparently, according to Magnus, there are spells that can be constructed to be activated by a warlock's death."
Emma glared at Church. She knew the cat had once lived in the New York Institute, but it seemed rude to show preference so blatantly. The cat was lying on his back on Jace's lap, purring and ignoring her.
"Like an alarm," Julian said, "that goes off when you open a door."
"Yes, but in this case death is the open door," said Diana.
"So what's the solution?" asked Emma.
"We probably need his body to turn the spell off, so to speak," said Jace. "And a clue as to how he did it would be nice."
The ruins of the Convergence have been picked over pretty thoroughly, Clary said. But we'll check out Malcolm's house tomorrow, just to be sure.
It's rubble, Julian warned.
Rubble that will have to be cleared away soon before mundanes notice it, said Diana. There's a glamour on it, but it's temporary. That means the site will only be undisturbed for another few days.
And there's no harm taking a last look, said Jace.
Especially as Magnus has given us some idea on what to look for.
He rubbed Church's ear, but didn't elaborate.
The Black Volume is a powerful necromantic object, said Perfect Diego. It could be causing disturbances we cannot even imagine. Driving the deepest dwelling of sea demons to crawl up onto our shores means mundanes are in danger. A few have already disappeared from the pier.
So, said Jace, a team of Centaurians is going to arrive here tomorrow.
Centaurians? Panic flashed in Julian's eyes, a look of fear and vulnerability that Emma guessed was visible only to her. It was gone almost instantly.
Why?
Centaurians. Elite shadow hunters. They trained at the Scholomance, a school carved into the rock walls of the Carpathian Mountains, surrounded by an icy lake. They studied esoteric lore and were experts in fairies and the cold peace. And also, apparently, sea demons.
This is excellent news, said Perfect Diego.
He would say that, Emma thought. Smugly, he touched the pin at his shoulder.
They will be able to find the body and the book.
Hopefully, Clary said.
But you're already here, Clary, said Julian, his voice deceptively mild. You and Jace. If you brought in Simon and Isabel and Alec and Magnus, I bet you could find the body right away.
He doesn't want strangers here, Emma thought. People who would pry into the Institute's business, demand to talk to Uncle Arthur. He had managed to preserve the Institute's secrets, even through everything that had happened with Malcolm. And now they were threatened again by random Centaurians.
Clary and I are only stopping by, Jace said. We can't stay in search. Though we'd like to. We're on assignment from the Council.
What kind of assignment? Emma said.
What mission could be more important than retrieving the Black Volume, clearing up the mess Malcolm had made once and for all?
But she could tell from the look that Jace and Clary exchanged that there was a world of more important things out there, ones she couldn't imagine.
Emma couldn't help a small explosion of bitterness inside, the wish that she were just a bit older. That she could be equal to Jace and Clary, know their secrets and the Council's secrets.
I'm so sorry, Clary said. We can't say.
So you're not even going to be here? Emma demanded. While all this is going on and our Institute is invaded?
Emma, Jace said. We know that you're used to being alone and untroubled here, to having only Arthur to answer to. If only he knew. But that was impossible. He went on.
But the purpose of an institute is not just to centralize Clave activity, but to house shadow hunters who must be accommodated in a city they don't live in. There are 50 rooms here that no one is using, so unless there's a pressing reason they can't come.
The words hung in the air. Diego looked down at his hands. He didn't know the full truth about Arthur, but Emma guessed that he suspected.
You can tell us, Clary said. We'll keep it in the strictest confidence.
But it wasn't Emma's secret to tell. She held herself back from looking at Mark or Christina, Diana or Julian, the only others at the table who knew the truth about who really ran the Institute. A truth that would need to be hidden from the Centaurians, who would be duty-bound to report it to the Council.
Uncle Arthur hasn't been well, as I assume you know. Julian said, gesturing toward the empty chair where the Institute's head would normally have sat. I was concerned the Centaurians might worsen his condition, but considering the importance of their mission, we'll make them as comfortable as possible.
Since the Dark War, Arthur has been prone to flare-ups of headaches and pain in his old wounds, added Diana. I'll run interference between him and the Centaurians until he's feeling better.
There's really nothing to worry about, said Diego. They're Centaurians, disciplined, orderly soldiers. They won't be throwing wild parties or making unreasonable demands.
He put an arm around Christina.
I'll be glad to have you meet some of my friends. Christina smiled back at him. Emma couldn't help but glance toward Mark to see if he was looking at Christina and Diego the way he often did, a way that made her wonder how Julian could miss it.